Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Electra Naismith, and at 1300 GMT on Monday the 12th of August, these are our main stories. Hong Kong International Airport cancels all flights as police prepare to clear thousands of protesters occupying the terminal. We hear from disputed Kashmir, still under lockdown as it celebrates Eid al-Adha. Also in this podcast...
The way you came at me right now... Girl, don't yell. We're all here for love. Don't yell. Don't embarrass.
Priyanka Chopra defends herself against accusations she's a warmonger, and Welsh police warn people against mocking a wanted man's hairstyle. But we start at Hong Kong International Airport, where all flights have been cancelled for the day after thousands of protesters occupied the terminal. Our correspondent Stephen McDonnell is at the airport and spoke to us shortly before we recorded this podcast.
There are still thousands of protesters sitting down on the floor in the arrivals hall at Hong Kong Airport. Now, it's not that the police have cleared the others who were here. I mean, there would now be, I'd say, a quarter of the size of the crowd as there was earlier. It's that word came through that the police were threatening to arrest them, to conduct mass arrests, and there was something of an exodus. We saw them pouring out of the terminal and walking towards the city. One of the reasons why people would not want to be detained here today is that we've had fresh threats from the central government that the movement here, I suppose, generally has, quote, sown the seeds of terrorism, unquote. But you can imagine if people were to be picked up on terrorism charges, that could mean having no lawyer for quite some time. It could mean being held in detention for extended periods without trial. And for these many young students, the rest of the life in front of them, they may not want to necessarily face that prospect. However, the remarkable thing has been that despite those threats, that there are many thousands still here. They're sitting on the ground and chanting pro-democracy slogans, criticising the government, criticising the police. And while there are no outgoing flights, those flights which were inbound are now being allowed to land again, and the passengers are coming through and to the sound of these chants as they arrive in Hong Kong, and they know firsthand straight away that this is a place in the midst of a political crisis.
Stephen, what are people saying to you? What's the mood now amongst the protesters?
Well, they've changed their strategy. You know, it was one a couple of weeks ago of that really they were taking it up to the authorities in pitched battles. Now there have been hundreds of arrests. The police said today in recent months 700 arrests, in fact. And so their strategy is much more of a hit-and-run strategy. So while they're here now, if the police did turn up and start threatening people, they would go. They'd go quickly because they want to be able to live to protest another day, if you like, and it is making it tough for the authorities to take the wind out of this movement, which just keeps going.
Indian-administered Kashmir has now been under an unprecedented lockdown for a week after India revoked its special constitutional status, which dated back decades. But as the region celebrates the Muslim festival of Eid al-Adha, media reports in Delhi speak of an ease in restrictions to allow movement for worshippers. In the city's main city, Srinagar, there's still no internet or functioning telecommunications. Thousands of Indian soldiers are on alert in the state and are patrolling the streets. A local resident, Asif Mohammed, said he found himself in the firing line of the security forces.
We were on our way to a prayer meeting to mark Eid. On the way, we met army and police officials. They started firing tear gas shells and rubber bullets. A lot of women and men were injured, as were children.
Our correspondent Rahul Tandon is in Delhi and spoke to us a little earlier.
I've just come from a briefing by the Indian Foreign Secretary Vijay Gokhale, where he basically said that the majority of the mosques in Indian-administered Kashmir had been open since the early morning and that people had been able to go and pray on Eid. But the pictures that we're seeing coming in from Indian-administered Kashmir, that there are photos of people going to local mosques, show deserted streets. They show that some of the largest mosques in the area have remained closed today, and that lockdown has really been in place in much of the area. And I think the question that the Indian government is still not able to answer, and was a question that was put to the Foreign Secretary at the briefing a short while ago, was how long is this lockdown going to take in place? You know, we're on day 7. Now it's a week since the announcement was made by the Home Secretary Amit Shah that the constitutional status of Indian-administered Kashmir was going to change. The only response that we've had from the Foreign Secretary so far is that there are miscreants who are trying to cause trouble in the area, and it is because of security why these very intense restrictions are still in place.
Because when the restrictions were eased on Friday for Friday prayers, we saw those very large protests, thousands on the streets. I suppose that's the dilemma the Indian government has. What can they do about that? What do they plan to do about that?
There's no clear indication, really, because I think you raise a very valid point there. The longer that you keep people under some sort of lock and key, under a lockdown, that level of frustration will grow. Now, what the Indian government is trying to get across is that they believe that Article 370, which gave this region autonomy, hasn't worked at all, and that they believe that the new strategy is in the interests of the people. The difficulty for us and other news organizations is finding it very difficult to hear from those people to find out if they actually hold the same views that the Indian government says they claim to hold.
Rahul Tandon in Delhi. Well, Kashmir is also in the news for another reason today, because of an altercation involving the Indian actress Priyanka Chopra. Back in February, the Bollywood star, who's now based in the US, tweeted "Victory to India, hashtag Indian Armed Forces." That was also a time of soaring tension between India and Pakistan. India had just carried out an airstrike in Pakistani territory and what it said was a terrorist training camp in Pakistan-administered Kashmir. Chopra was confronted by a Pakistani audience member at a cosmetics event in Los Angeles at the weekend. Ellie Costello told me the story.
Hi, Letra. So, as you say, this weekend, Priyanka Chopra was at the BeautyCon event in LA, along with lots of other celebrities and influencers. And she was taking part in a question-answer session. And she started by talking about humanity and sisterhood and how we should all be kind to one another. The microphone was then passed to a young woman who has named herself on Twitter as Aisha Malik, and she said that it was hard to hear the Bollywood actress talk about humanity because, as her neighbour, as a Pakistani, she thinks that Priyanka Chopra is a hypocrite, in that she was referring to Priyanka's role as a UN ambassador for peace. So let's hear some of that exchange now.
You're encouraging nuclear war against Pakistan. There's no winner in this. As a Pakistani, millions of people like me have supported you in your business.
I hear you. Whenever you're done venting. Got it? Done? Okay, cool. So, I have many, many friends. Thanks, girls. I have many, many friends from Pakistan. And I am from India. And war is not something that I'm really fond of, but I am patriotic. So, I'm sorry that if I hurt sentiments to people who do love me and have loved me, but I think that all of us have a sort of middle ground that we all have to walk, just like you probably do as well. The way you came at me right now, girl, don't yell. We're all here for love. Don't yell. Don't embarrass yourself.
Well, that all sounded a bit tense. So what's the reaction been like, Ellie?
Well, as you can imagine, the tweet itself got a lot of backlash at the time. So the video of this altercation has been viewed almost 2 million times. And it sparked a huge Twitter debate in both India and Pakistan over the way that Priyanka handled herself. Indians are applauding her calm, graceful response. But Pakistanis say that she belittled Aisha, you know, asking if she'd finished ranting, telling her not to yell. Aisha herself has tweeted, actually, and this too has gone viral. Hi, I'm the girl that yelled at Priyanka Chopra. She gaslit me and turned the narrative around on me being the bad guy. As a UN ambassador, that was so irresponsible. And Priyanka Chopra at this time has said nothing.
People of South Asian origin have been living in the Caribbean for more than 180 years. But Chandani Pasaud, founder of Indo-Caribbean London, says their contribution to the West Indies is overlooked and they're often excluded by the Asian community. Fearing that young British Indo-Caribbeans are turning away from their culture, she's single-handedly organising the UK's first Indo-Caribbean festival, as the BBC's Nalini Savathasan reports.
What's the formation here? Bollywood dance class with a Caribbean twist. Shannon Balram is one of the dancers preparing to perform at Indo-Caribbean Festival.
People think Caribbean and always think black. They don't think there are Indian people. And you'll see nights out for kind of Afrobeats and Latin music, that kind of thing, and Bollywood music. But people don't know about chutney music.
Chutney, like the food, is a mix. Caribbean music like soca and calypso infused with Indian words and melodies.
It's very spicy, it's very fiery, it's very fast, and it's great fun.
That's the festival's organiser, Chandani Prasad. But behind the laughs and smiles, she's worried.
I feel at the moment the culture, the Indo-Caribbean culture in this country is at a tipping point where if we don't start promoting our culture, especially to our younger generation, we're going to lose our culture.
She says that although most Indo-Caribbeans are ethnically Indian, younger people think it's cooler to identify with Caribbean culture. But Chandani says she's been shaped by her Indian heritage. At her house in East London, an Indian film plays in the living room while Chandani and her mum make roti. And on the wall are photos of her and her parents doing Kathak dance.
You're never Indian enough to be considered Indian, and you're never Caribbean enough to be considered a Caribbean person. So we're always stuck in this middle ground, but we don't need to be stuck in the middle ground because we have our own identity.
A few days later, it's festival day. The alcohol is flowing. Stores are selling roti, doubles, dal and rice. But there's also an art exhibition showing the hardships of Indian workers when they arrived in the Caribbean nearly two centuries ago. That's where I find 28-year-old Kaj. She's half Guyanese and half Punjabi.
It's good to see what my ancestors went through, how I've got to where I am now. A lot of people don't know where Guyana is, and like, I get a lot of questions. So if I want to answer those questions, I have to know about it myself, really.
Towards the end of the night, the party's still swinging with DJ Simply E, a household name amongst Indo-Caribbeans here. Chandani is delighted by how well it's all gone.
All of the UK people!
Didn't expect, you know, this many people to support. I think people do want to celebrate their culture when they have an evening like this to come out and really celebrate it.
Chandani is confident that the festival will return next year on a bigger scale as she works to preserve her distinctive Indo-Caribbean community.
The BBC's Nalini Savathasan reporting there. Still to come in this podcast.
It's been the home of 20th Century Fox UK since 1938. What is presently proposed is grossly oversized, and architecturally it doesn't relate to the character, appearance and significance of this part of the conservation area.
The landmark building under threat in the heart of London. Archaeologists working on an excavation at Mount Zion in Jerusalem have unearthed what's being described as evidence of the Babylonian conquest of the city. The find includes fragments of gold and silver jewellery, as well as Iron Age artefacts such as lamps and pots. Dr. Shimon Gibson is co-director of the Mount Zion excavation project in Jerusalem. He gave more details to the BBC's Carney Sharp.
I've just got back, actually, from the season of excavations in Jerusalem. It was very exciting. And during the course of the excavations, we came across a layer of ashes with broken bits of pottery and some arrowheads and a very nice piece of jewellery, totally unexpected. And when we pieced everything together and looked at it, it clearly had to have belonged to the siege of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar in 586 or 587 BC. And so this was something which we weren't expecting. We're digging all sorts of remains from different periods, and suddenly this came to light. So it was very exciting.
And do you know who it might have belonged to?
The piece of jewellery itself clearly indicates that the person who owned it was part of the elite of Jerusalem in the 6th century BC. It's very difficult to know whether it belonged to a woman or to a man, because it could have been part of a tassel or something like that, you know, and part of a shawl. And of course, both men and women at that time, especially those who were rich, would have had these kind of sort of garments. But But what's important is that we can relate it to the siege of Nebuchadnezzar that is referred to in the second book of Kings, you know, chapter 25. And it says that the city was besieged and there was a terrible famine in the city, and that the Babylonians, when they broke through the walls, they wrought a terrible destruction, which eventually led to the exile of all of the inhabitants to Babylon.
Why is this so important? Is it because some people don't believe the Bible to be a historical text and think of it as stories only?
I think many people have cast aspersions on the veracity of the biblical text. But there's no doubt about it that when it comes to basic stories which are in the Old Testament, such as the siege of Jerusalem in the 6th century, these are based on historical episodes. To find this evidence of destruction from the 6th century BC and to link it into that biblical text is a very exciting moment.
Dr. Shimon Gibson talking to Connie Sharp. Now, every big city has to try to marry the needs of development with the preservation of the historic, and London is no exception. An iconic building in Soho, in the heart of central London, is facing possible demolition. The 20th Century Fox building has stood as the studio's UK headquarters since it was built in the 1930s, but it could soon be torn down, as Farhana Dawood reports.
The 20th Century Fox jingle, made during the company's heyday and a reminder of the golden age of cinema. Now following a billion-dollar takeover by Disney earlier this year, London's 20th Century House, Fox's former UK headquarters, is under threat. The building stands in a corner of Soho Square. It was built in 1937 and opened a year later in a ceremony attended by screen and music hall legend Gracie Fields.
You want to follow me in? I'm on top. I think I'm going to top of the building.
Paul Bellewett is an architect who's helping the Soho Society get the building listed and protected.
It has special qualities in that it's been the home of 20th Century Fox UK since 1938. No other organisation has occupied it, and the good and the great came here to watch previews of the film before general release. The film preview cinemas are still in place, and a series of boardrooms survive, all of particular interest historically and architecturally. And in terms of the exterior of the building, it fits in very comfortably with the interwar Georgian revival buildings around here. And what is presently proposed is grossly oversized, and architecturally it doesn't relate to the character, appearance and significance of this part of the conservation area.
20th Century House is a tall, grand brick building. It has an elegant entrance portico with four stone columns, and atop the multi-story edifice is a classic neon circular sign containing the Fox logo, familiar to many filmgoers. Soho has a strong connection with the media and arts. Many people feel that link is part of the area's attraction, and there's a fear that some of the developments in recent years have caused an erosion of the area's uniqueness. In Soho Square, no one I spoke to was in favour of the proposed demolition.
It's a classic building in Soho Square, and it's really sad that they'd consider, is it going to be foreign investment or be whoever pays the highest? And that's not what it should be about, really. It's like, it's about preserving something that's kind of at the heart of Soho, which is film, the film industry. It's just a shame, really.
Everywhere in Soho, especially like this little square, complements each other, so glass building would just look very odd.
I guess Soho, back in the days, used to be more kind of like a cultural place where people were more unique and like you could express yourself, whereas now it's becoming more corporate in that sort of sense, and yeah, it's kind of losing its heritage. I wouldn't like for it to, you know, be something completely different and like them just make it some modern building.
The freeholder of the site, Royal London, declined to be interviewed but issued a statement which said the development would bring significant long-term benefits to Soho, including the creation of a new landscape public space and walking route. Royal London understands there is a significant interest in the development and is engaging with the local community to ensure the proposal is of the highest architectural quality and sits comfortably with its surroundings, including Soho Square. Westminster Council will make a decision on the proposal in the coming weeks.
Fahana Dawood there. To South Africa now, where a 20-year-old rare western black rhino who was blinded after a territorial dispute with another rhino has been given a new lease of life in the Eastern Cape. So how did rangers realise there was a problem? The conservationist Brett Barlow has been talking to my colleague James Copnell.
The reserve where he was on, they saw him walking around in circles, so they didn't know what was happening. So they immobilised him to look, and then they found out that he was blind. And they worked out that he was walking around in circles because he probably went blind in his left eye first. That's why he was walking in clockwise circles. And then a couple of months later, his right eye would have also gone blind.
Do we know how? Is it just a natural thing or involved in a fight of some sort?
It's like a boxer, one punch too many. And he had one detached retina. And the eye is quite an amazing thing, with the swelling normally with the retina when it detaches on the one side. The other side has almost like a sympathetic swelling. And it detaches as well. It's a pretty common occurrence in that this case.
And presumably he left to fend for himself. Well, he wouldn't have fended for very long.
He would have been eaten by lions by now. Apparently there were lions when they found him. And lions are very opportunistic. They pick up any weakness straight away.
So what did you do?
They put him in a holding boma while they were trying to assess, first of all, if it was a disease. But then they had an ophthalmic veterinary surgeon who examined him, who said it was the detached retinas. So they were unsure what to do. And I said, look, please, guys, we can't waste them. Every single rhino matters. So we started on a process which took us 7 months to give him to our care. And we've now built a facility for him. We've moved him to the new facility. And he's settling in wonderfully.
A facility for a blind rhino. You might have to describe a little bit what that looks like.
Because he'd been in a one design for 7 months, I did a mirror image of that design. So he knows, you know, orientated the right way direction-wise. So he knew if I took 3 steps this way, my door's there, 7 steps, my food's there, 2 steps to the right, my water's there. So I did a mirror image of that. And then we've built on an outside section now, almost like a big paddock, which will gradually increase. And as I said, he walks in clockwise circles. So I've done it almost like a wagon wheel, 2 spokes of a wagon wheel, going out from a V to his door. And with the right-hand side coming against his door. So I'm thinking, if he walks and he goes in a clockwise circle, he'll come across clockwise, he will hit the barrier, and he can follow that in back to his water and his food.
Is he happy in this new life, do you think?
You know, he has adjusted so well. The only thing he doesn't really like is total quiet. When it's very quiet, I think he gets a little bit nervous and sudden noises startle him. So what we do is we actually play radio stations for him. So he has a radio on in his boma 24 hours a day.
Is he going to be listening to this interview?
He will probably be listening to this interview if I could find it on my channel, but I'll definitely play it to him. But he likes to have some sort of, almost like I call it his white noise. He likes to have some background music. It keeps him calm.
There will be people who say, well, look, why don't you just let nature take his course, let him carry on in the wild and just see what happens. You argue strongly against that, I guess.
I'm very against that. I firmly believe every rhino matters. We've got to save rhino one animal at a time. This bull, he was the biggest bull on the reserve. He was the best genetics. I'll try get a female for him and he'll carry on breeding and procreating and his genes will be spreading.
Conservationist Brett Barlow. Welsh police here in Britain are warning social media users not to mock the eye-catching hairstyle of a wanted criminal, or they may face prosecution for harassment. The statement came after tens of thousands of people commented on Jermaine Taylor's mugshot, posted online after he breached his licence conditions relating to drugs offences. David Lewis takes up the story.
It seems Gwent Police Force's question of, have you seen this 21-year-old man, has gone down a little too well. Officers posted a picture on their Facebook page asking the public to come forward with any information on Jermaine Taylor's whereabouts. Much to the seeming delight of thousands of internet users, the wanted man has a rather unusual hairstyle, with 2 pronounced tufts adorning the top of his scalp. More than 85,000 people have so far commented, liked or shared the snapshot, but the popularity of the post has forced the police to urge caution. In a message underneath the viral photo, officers are reminding social media users to tread carefully when commenting and insist saying something which is grossly offensive or menacing could be investigated and charges could even be brought. For possible legal reasons, I can't share too many of the comments. Some replies have been mocking, others sarcastic. The top-rated reply, with more than 7,000 likes, simply reads, "He was last seen in town. Police are combing the area." The hunt for Mr. Taylor continues.
That report from David Lewis. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alettra Naismith. Until next time, goodbye.